Good morning and welcome. I'm Penny Eiler, a member of Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My pronouns are she, her, and hers. Prairie is church done differently. We enjoy our discussions. We dress casual, and our services are informal. During our services, it's not unusual to see somebody knitting, somebody taking notes, or somebody nodding off, or somebody correcting the presider's mistakes. Our congregation's religious pluralism runs the gamut, including humanism, atheist, as well as the religious and the spiritual. We strive to be welcoming to all ages, all religious backgrounds, all abilities and inabilities, and whatever your sexual or gender identity. Our UU principles, boiled down for children, are: each person is important. Be kind in all you do. We're free to learn together and search for what is true. All people need a voice. Build a fair and peaceful world. We care for Earth's lifeboat. Our opening words this morning will be read by Patty Stockdale.
Thank you. In this holiday season, may the darkness of winter be dispelled in this festival of lights, and may the darkness of ignorance be dispelled in the strength of compassion, reason, and sharing.
This morning, Chris Porter will read our global chalice lighting.
This is from Reverend Arianto Nugroho from the Unitarian Christian Church in Indonesia. Lights are shining right on me there.
Step them.
Oh. The Lord not only gave this earth to humankind for their workspace, but also to take care of it. It is a pity that humanity forgets and ignores the caring of this world. So climate change makes earth languish and the people suffer. It is not enough for us just to deepen our spirituality. It is not enough for us to serve good to humanity. We are also called to ignite hope for the future generations that they will still have this earth as their prosperous and fruitful home, not to languish and fading away ground. We light our chalice today with hope, prayer, and commitment that we will take part in keeping the sustainability of this earth. We make this calling part of our spirituality, that we will take up our responsibility and will urge the other to also take responsibility to care for this earth and save it from climate crisis.
Thank you. Our presenter this morning is Stephen Carpenter, and he is an emeritus director, and Stephen Alfred Forbes professor of the Center for Limnology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His current research topics are control and dynamics of bloom of cyanobacteria, blue-green algae, in our lakes, cause of collapse in recreational fisheries, and global trade-offs among energy, food, and water resources. Carpenter's research has been recognized by international awards, including the Stockholm Water Prize and the Margolif Prize, and the Research Awards of Professional Societies. He is a member of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences and a foreign member of the Royal Swedish Academy of Science. And let's welcome Mr. Carpenter.
Thank you. Thank you, Penny, and very happy to be here. When Penny called for silent meditation, my computer went into silent meditation, and so we're going to have to wake it back up. And there it is. Okay. I'm here to tell you about a project that a group of us. Shown, and I'm not going to go through all the names, you may know some of these people. A group of us started this project in 2009 at UW-Madison to begin to bring the public and scientists together to think about the future of the lakes. What do we want for the lakes, and what do we want for the land around them? And I'm going to give you a summary of where we are with that project. How many people know what a watershed is? Oh, that's pretty good. Okay, it's the area of land that collects water for a river or lake. And our watershed is this area here around the Madison Lakes. This is a different image of the same thing. This one is an air photo. This one shows land use, land cover by different colors. This is the Mississippi watershed, Mississippi River watershed, and we're that little red blip right there. So watersheds aren't nested in each other. We're just a small part of the Mississippi watershed. And you can see the pink area is urban, and the urban area is concentrated around these two headwater lakes, Mendota and Monona. And most of the rest of the land is agriculture, which is yellow, and there are a few tiny little patches of native vegetation in the area. One of them is UW Arboretum, which is right here, but we don't have much native vegetation anymore. And really, to understand a body of water, you start with its watershed. Almost everything that goes on in that body of water can be explained by events in the watershed. And we've got challenges in our watershed that you probably know from reading the newspaper. We're losing agricultural land. Our population is increasing fairly quickly because Dane County is very prosperous economically compared to other counties around us and most of the rest of Wisconsin. So we have urban development pressure that's taking farmland away. There's increasing demand for biofuels. 40% of our agricultural production now is used for industrial feedstocks. It doesn't feed anything. It's used for most of it to make fuel for automobiles. We've got lots of impacts of climate change. They are all around us. I'll show you a few in the talk. And we're seeing increasing numbers of floods. The rivers are going over their banks, the lakes are going over their banks more often, simply because of these big bursts of big storms and clustered storms that we're seeing more of. And this is creating quite a challenge for managing the lakes. Our water quality problems are most evident to people who walk around the lakes as these thick scums of algae. And this is a picture I took right outside the Center for Limnology, where I work. And they're pretty common. These are composed of cyanobacteria, the most ancient organism, most ancient plants on Earth. And they're still around. They make toxins called cyanotoxins, which are very deadly. They're liver toxins or nerve toxins, and you should stay away from the water when there are, and make sure your pets stay away. Humans are not too likely to drink that water, but your pets might, and it can kill them. We've had, as far as I know, we've only had one human fatality from drinking the water in Madison, but a lot of people have had issues with their pets. So these toxins, blooms of these toxic floating plants are caused mainly by phosphorus. Phosphorus inputs to the lake are the principal cause. Scientific term for that is load. Phosphorus load is the amount of phosphorus that comes in a year. And this curve shows about 20 years of inputs from two of our major streams, the Ahara River and Pheasant Branch, and there's no downward trend there, even though upwards of $25 million have been spent to reduce phosphorus input. There's no trend. the management is not reducing it, and we continue to have the algae problems. One of the there are two main reasons that phosphorus input is not decreasing. One is the soils are now rich in phosphorus, so the since we started using fertilizer heavily after World War II, we've had several decades to build up really high concentrations in the soil, and those are not decreased by crops very quickly. So the soils are very rich, and we're getting bigger rains, and the rains are coming in clusters, and those big clustered rains drive a lot of soil erosion and a lot of phosphorus movement into the lakes. So the question we asked was, how could changes in the way we use land, changes in the climate, and changes in human demand for land and food resources and so on impact future generations in our watershed? Ecosystem services is just a technical word for things you get free from nature, like food, drinkable water, breathable air, those sorts of things. The project was started formally in 2010. We took a 60-year time horizon out to 2070. We picked 60 years because we thought most people could relate to 60 years. Most people knew their grandparents, and the difference in age between you and your grandparents is probably around 60 years. And most people either know their grandchildren or hope to know their grandchildren someday. And that's also a 60-year span. So we felt 60 years was something people could deal with and have some intuition about. So we wanted to start, even though this was a science project, we wanted to build it around things people wanted to know about the Yajara. We started from the principle that we need to engage the public, and this whole project needs to be a conversation with the public, and we will let that conversation motivate the science that we do. So we wanted to start by gathering perspectives from people about the future of the watershed. And of course, there are lots of perspectives. We could not talk individually with all 372,000 people in the watershed. We had to have a way of sampling them. And so we created a random sample of people in the watershed. People's names were chosen by lottery. And we went into their offices or their kitchen tables and we interviewed them. And we also had workshops of about 15 or 20 people. And the workshops were on campus. We had coffee and snacks. And we used the workshops. And again, these were randomly assembled groups of people. And we used the workshops to talk about the future of the lakes. The kinds of questions that we asked were, what are your hopes for the region? How do you hope it comes out in by 2070? What are your fears? What concerns you? How might it turn out that would be bad, that you would like to avoid? What do you want to preserve? What are the things about the region that you think are really good and should be carried forward in the future? What would you like to change? What are the things about the region you wish were different, and how would you like to change them? And what about the region do you think is resilient? In other words, it's not going to change very easily, even if you want to change it. And what is unstable? Unstable things are changeable things. And so what might be changed? And so we had all these conversations with individuals in their offices and kitchen tables and with small groups in workshops, and we gathered a lot of feedback about the future. And we sat down with that information and asked, well, are there clusters of beliefs about how to proceed? are there really 372,000 different viewpoints, or are there clumps of people who kind of think the same way? It turned out there were. And then what are the differences between the clusters? So what makes the clusters similar and what makes them different? And we went back and forth repeatedly with the data, and we argued about this quite a bit. Once we picked our clusters, we constructed a plausible story about the logical consequences of the beliefs that went into each cluster. So if this cluster is really the way the world works and the way things are going to go, how will that play out by 2070? And we iterated many, many times. We went back to the people we interviewed over and over again and asked, hey, are we doing this right? Are we getting, are we moving in the right direction? So in summary, we constructed a sample of people. We didn't interview all 372,000 people. And we got, we went through those questions about their beliefs, hopes, and fears about the future. We clustered the samples, and we condensed it to four stories about the future. Why four? Well, some of you may be professors or teachers. I spent my life as a professor or teacher. And one of the rules of teaching is the rule of hand. The rule of hand is that if you have a group of undergraduates for 45 minutes, you can get across at most five things. That's all you can teach, is five things in 45 minutes, at most. It doesn't have to be five. That's the rule of hand, sort of standard teaching 101. Another thing that we had found, I've done these sorts of exercises all around the world, and I ran a global exercise, an exercise for the whole planet in the early 2000s. So I have a lot of experience with these scenario exercises. And one of the things I found is that decision makers and politicians always want to know what the middle one is. They don't want to think about the variability, they want to know about the one that's right in the middle. And if you pick an odd number, then it becomes pretty obvious what the middle one is. So it can't be an odd number. So we've got the rule of hand, so we can have five at most. We can't have five, because that's an odd number. We can't have three. We can't have one. So we're down to two or four. And two is not enough, so we picked four. It's as simple as that. That's how we came up with four. So it's really impossible to tell which one we think is true or the most realistic, the most accurate. It's just four different views of the world. And you have to embrace that diversity to understand the message of the scenarios. So we iterated with stakeholders to make the stories better and better, and through this phase, there's no math, there's no computer programs, it's just stories. So we're telling stories with people, and we're developing art to illustrate the four different stories. And we iterated with folks until we thought we had the stories just about right. We gave them names. I'll say a little bit more about what the names mean in a minute. And each story was organized around a central question. So a story called Abandonment and Renewal was motivated by the question, what if we don't adapt to climate and social pressures on land and water? What if we just don't do enough or don't do anything? The logical consequence of that is that toxic water will make the region unlivable and everyone will leave. And we played out the consequences of that in this scenario. Second one was, what if we increase our investment in education, green technology, and better land and water management? And in fact, green technology is a possible development angle for this region. We have a great deal of science capacity, and we have a lot of people interested in natural resources. We could develop a green technology industry right here. So we just imagined that and played it out until 2070. Third one, what if there's a generational shift toward values that embrace environmental stewardship? And in fact, there are indications that that is happening. There's a project called the Global Values Project. You can go to the website and read about, they take a random sample of values of people in a large number of countries, and they do it every 10 years. So you get a decadal sample of people's values, and young people definitely have stronger environmental values than older people do. You can see, and that's very clear in the United States, for example. In fact, there was a study published in the New York Times this week showing the age distribution of support for action on climate change, and it's the younger people who want to do something about it for the most part. So what if there was just a really strong shift toward conservation values, toward stewardship of the planet for ourselves and future generations? And then the final one is, what if governance changed at federal and state levels so that clean fresh water was valued as a resource? So essentially, clean fresh water becomes a crop. Farmers are rewarded for producing clean fresh water as a crop. We looked at the logical consequences of each of those four stories. And once the stories were developed, we linked them to computer models. And I'm not going to go through this in great detail, but we spent a lot of time on this. We wrote a couple of papers about it. And basically, the idea was connect the narratives to the models, see what the models say, and then ask if the narratives need to be changed. So, for example, maybe the narratives assume something that's biophysically impossible. And if the models say that, we should change the stories, because we don't want biophysically impossible stories. So we went back and forth with that a little bit. I'm simply showing you this to show you that there's a whole lot of styles. I'm not going to go through this, because there will not be a quiz. This is not going to be on the quiz. But a group of really bright people worked on these models for a number of years. And I'll show you some of the things they account for in a minute. So we came up with quantitative projections for each of the four scenarios for 2010 to 2070. So now we've got the stories, we've got the art, and now we actually say, well, what's going to happen to weather, land use, transportation, livestock, farmland management in each of those scenarios? What's going to go on with food production, carbon storage, groundwater storage and groundwater quality, surface water quality, cyanobacteria blooms, natural ecosystems? All of those things were put together for that 60-year period. Are you with me? Is this making sense? Okay. And we've now got quite a few products online, and you're free to go to this website. All this stuff is free. There's, you know, just download whatever you want. You can look at the stories with illustrations. We have a short video of each story, about 5 minutes or so, if you'd rather see a video than read a story. And by the way, each story is written about the length of an article in Atlantic magazine, and it was written by a real writer. You know, not by an academic. We actually hired a real writer to write it, so they're good. You know, they're entertaining, and they're illustrated. We have a reader's guide for book clubs, church groups, and so on that helps you decide how you might compare and contrast the stories, some questions that you might ask each other as you read the stories. We have blog posts and videos about the process and findings. We're out of money now, so we don't have a staff anymore, but we had a blog that was a weekly blog that had a lot of interesting stories about the lakes in it. Those still exist. We had a writing contest, you may have noticed that, with Madison Magazine and Wisconsin Public Radio. And the three winning stories were read on WPR. They were stories about the future of Madison in 2070. And they were published in Madison Magazine, so those stories are still out there. Wisconsin Public TV did a TV show about our project. It's an hour-long special, and if you missed it, the link to it is at our website, so you can just find the link, click on it, and you know, watch the story on your computer. Dozens of interviews and public presentations. We presented model results to technical staffs of the relevant agencies, the city, the county, DNR. Lots of technical papers, theses. We graduated about a dozen students who have become a diaspora of this method, and they've gone forth to greater glory, and mostly in universities, a few work for agencies. And as a result of this project, we meet regularly with the county executive and the Lakes and Watersheds Commission about these issues. They use us as a resource. So lots of things there from the project you could look at if you like. Now I'm going to give you some results really quickly. These are the climate analogs for the scenarios in 2070. So each scenario, it's as if Madison moved further south, right, because of climate change. And there's a fairly modest one that just takes us south of Chicago. Another one takes us to Arkansas. Someone mentioned they're going on vacation to Arkansas. You can just wait. You may be going to Arkansas. Kansas, Indiana. The looking back on the project, remember we started this in 2009, and we picked climate scenarios that were sort of middle of the road for 2009, and they're too mild. We should have, the projections now are much worse than they were in 2009, and the models are dead on, so it's unlikely that those more severe projections are a result of a defect in the models, is that emissions of greenhouse gases are worse than we thought they would be in 2009. So we would, if we were doing this project now, we would be going further south.
Why wouldn't you be going north?
Because we're not going north.
Our climate is going north.
Oh yeah, the climate that we live in now is going north. Well, that's a good question. It's we're assuming here that people are pretty much going to stay at home because they've already bought their house and whatnot, and their neighbors are here, and so the climate is moving over us, rather us chasing the climate. And I apologize for my colloquial way of saying it. Is this making sense to others? Okay. All right, talk a little bit about some of the results. This slide shows annual maximum lake levels in Lake Monona. The dashed line is what's typically considered a flood. And I'm not going to go through these in detail, but you can see that there are lots of floods here. Here's an example of one of the floods. This is a map of one of the flooded areas, so quite a bit around Lake Wingra, quite a bit around Lake Monona, and a lot of the isthmus and up toward the airport is flooded. Those are low-lying areas. When we showed this map to the city engineer, he said, "You can't show that in public because people will panic and the realty industry will go crazy." And of course, we're scientists, so we just put on the lid anyway. But with an explanation. But it turned out that it was really pretty good. So this is an actual flood that occurred. The storm occurred on the 20th of August, 2018. Some of you may remember it.
Yes.
It was a very intense storm, and it fell. A lot of the rain was right over Lake Mendota, and Lake Mendota was high anyway. So the center of the storm for a period of time when it was raining hard was right over Lake Mendota, which is the worst possible situation for getting a flood. And so here is our prediction that I just showed you of the flooded area on the isthmus, and here's what actually happened. And I just took this off the newspaper webpage, actually, the Wisconsin State Journal webpage. The blue is flooded areas here. It's not bad, the fit is not bad. And so even though we were told that we shouldn't show anybody this graph, it happened a couple of years after we ran the model prediction. So we have a lot of low-lying areas. This area was historically very wet, and as precipitation goes up, and as we get more big storms, and the storms are bunched up, it's clusters, storm clusters often do this damage, we can expect more flooding. It's just going to be the way it goes. So I'm sorry if I offended anyone from the realty industry, but if you're a realtor, what you can do is say buy on higher ground. Okay, and this, I apologize for this because it has a statistic on it, but I just want to show we calculated the effects of different factors on phosphorus input to the lake. So here is phosphorus input through Pheasant Branch after a big storm. So I'm talking about this kind of input of phosphorus, and asked what are the factors that control it. Turns out land use, actually, whether the land is a farm or a suburban area or native vegetation, doesn't matter all that much. Land management matters a lot. So whether a farm is managed for grazing versus, heavy animal production and a concentrated animal feeding operation, that matters a lot. That has a big impact. The average climate doesn't really matter that much. So, where we're going with the average is, it matters. The warmer average and wetter average matters. But what really matters is the extremes. And we're getting more big rainfall events, and they're coming in packages. So it's the extremes, not the average, that are really causing the increase in phosphorus to the lakes. Is that okay? Yeah, I wondered if I should show something labeled partial R squared, but I think you got it. Okay. So precipitation and extremes. So this is the precipitation in millimeters per year. So 1,000 millimeters is about 100 centimeters, which is about 40 inches. So this is about 40 inches. If you prefer inches, and I apologize for using millimeters. We're, even though climate's going to change, we're not going to move all the way to Europe. We're still be using inches. And you can see, whatever the units, you can see a pretty steady increase here. This graph shows the 10-year return level in millimeters per day. So return level is the essentially the size of a 10-year storm, a storm that would be the biggest storm in 10 years. That's the way to think of this. So the biggest storm in a decade, statistically, is going up pretty steadily. And this is not trivial. The difference from here to here is about an inch. So the biggest storm in a decade is getting bigger, and an extra inch of rain in an extreme storm matters a lot. This is another one I may regret showing, and and stop me if I should not show it. This is the precipitation return level in millimeters, or the return time in years. And this is the phosphorus input return level in kilograms per day. So the same kind of analysis for phosphorus. So let's pick, say, a 10-year storm. So we'll pick a return time of 10 years. That's about 100 millimeters, which is 4 inches. And let's read up and see how much phosphorus that is. So we read up here, we get come here, we read over here. That's about 90,000 kilograms of phosphorus in one storm. 90,000 kilograms of phosphorus is 25% of the typical annual load in the long run. So that's a huge storm. And we're going to get more of those. That's all this means, is that the trend toward more big storms is going to mean more big phosphorus inputs. Water quality, they're in general, well, okay, I am going to explain this. We measure water quality with, the easiest way to measure it is with something called a Secchi disc. And you can think of a dinner plate on a rope, and you lower the dinner plate down into the lake, and you measure the depth where you can't see it anymore. And that's called the Secchi depth. And the deeper it is, the clearer the water is. Are you with me?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is a plot of Secchi depth versus time in each of the four scenarios. And, you know, there's a tendency, for it to get a little better in each case, which is good. The real shocker here is that the most important thing that controls the Secchi depth, the water clarity, is the presence or absence of this little animal called Daphnion. Daphnion is a really important grazer in the lakes. As you can see, they're about the size of a football. I was checking to see if you're paying attention. They're about this big. They're about the distance between my fingers. But there are millions of them out there, and they're all female. And the females lay eggs in proportion to the amount of food they're getting. So they, since they're parthenogens, since they're all female populations, they produce eggs like crazy. And they can grow really quickly if there's an algae bloom, a bloom of those toxic algae, and begin to control things. And whether we have them or not matters a lot. So if we have a lot of them, we have fairly clear water and the Secchi dip disappears pretty deep in the lake. If we have very few of them, we actually have to lift the disc out of the lake to see it. That's a sign of really bad water clarity. So what's going on with... Well, if we could reduce agricultural runoff, that would make the biggest difference. I'm simply pointing out that this animal makes a difference as well. The best thing we could do would be to control the phosphorus runoff. And I can skip, are we running short on time? I can skip the animal story.
No, go on.
Okay, all right. So before 1987, we had very few Daphnia. We had much poorer water quality. And at that time, we had very few game fish in the lake and a lot of small fish. So with few game fish, a lot of small fish, these small fish ate the Daphnia. There were not very many Daphnia, and water quality was poor. In 1988, the Center for Limnology at the university and DNR teamed up to change fishing regulations and stock a bunch of game fish in Lake Mendota and greatly increase the number of large predatory fish in the lake simply by changing fishing regulations and stocking practices. And as a result, We had a very quick response, decrease in amount of the small fish and an increase in the amount of Daphnia, a huge increase in the amount of Daphnia. They weren't really wearing Bucky Badger sweaters. But other than that, this is accurate. They were big. And we got better water quality. And actually, this decade had the best water quality in Lake Mendota since data first started to be taken in 1875. So really huge improvement in the lake. And then we had an invader. And it's an invader from the Caspian Sea region of Europe. And it's called spiny water flea. This is a picture of one. And it also eats Daphnia. And fish do not eat spiny water flea. Spiny water fleas are fairly big. They're about this long, so they're about two or three times bigger than a Daphnia, maybe four times bigger than a Daphnia. But they have this long spine, and if not for the spine, they'd be delicious to a fish. It would be, you know, those canapes that have like a slice of sausage wrapped in bacon and then a toothpick in it. They're like that, except you have to eat the toothpick. The fish don't want the toothpick. So these things have just exploded. They eat the Daphnia, and our water quality is worse. So we're dealing with this now. This is our current situation. But I just wanted to bring this up as showing that even though phosphorus is really the heart of the problem, the way we manage the animals in the lake also has an effect on the water quality. And right now we have, due to invasions, we have some issues in the lake. We've also got zebra mussels. They came in just in the last few years. And how many of you have seen a zebra mussel? Okay, so if you walk along the Lake Mendota shoreline, in after about the 1st of August, you're probably going to see some on the rocks or buoys, piers, boat bottoms. As a result of the zebra mussels, we get clear water much of the time. So they eat a lot of algae, but they don't eat the poisonous ones. So we are getting... When we get a toxic bloom, it is really severe. So the lake is it's clearer most of the time, but when it blooms, it's a big, thick mat of severely toxic algae. We're getting more growth of rooted plants, which boaters and swimmers dislike. We're getting more periphyton, that's a technical term for green blot, on the bottom, and it washes up on the beaches. And more cuts and abrasions from sharp shells. Many beaches you can't really wade now barefoot because you're going to get your feet cut. You have to wade wearing shoes or flip-flops. And fish production is changing, and we're not quite sure how that's going to play out now. But we're going to end up with a different fishery as a result of this invasion. It's still playing out. So, species invasions, and this is another species from the Caspian Sea, so we really didn't need these here. And another thing we could do is figure out how to stop doing that. Yes?
How did they get here from the Caspian Sea?
Pardon?
How did they get here from the Caspian Sea?
They get here on shipping. So, through the Great Lakes, Minnesota and Wisconsin and Upper Michigan ship a lot of taconite ore, iron ore, to the Caspian Sea region for making steel. And the boats come over with full of ballast water, so they don't bring a product back to the United States. They come back empty, but they have to have ballast water in them or they'll roll over in storms in the Atlantic. And then when they get to the Great Lakes, they pump out the ballast water, and it's full of European and Asian plants and animals. Is that legal? No. They're required to swap the water that they get from the Caspian Sea. They're required to swap that for Atlantic Ocean water in the middle of the Atlantic, and that will kill the invasive animals. That would have killed zebra mussels, and it would kill the spiny water flea, but they don't do it. And we don't have good enforcement of those rules. You know, what are we going to do? Have submarines out there shooting down sinking ships that don't? It's a hard enforcement problem. I've gotten way off my topic. Okay. So, really, what we need to be asking ourselves, since, you know, we have humans, the people here, have a lot of responsibility for the lakes and the land around them. And what do we want to get from this watershed? What should it provide? What do we want it to provide? And what's biophysically possible? Of course, sometimes what you want, you can't get. What you want and what you can get biophysically can be two different things. But we need to consider that as well. What's socially acceptable? And what changes are people willing to make? And what choices would build resilience for the future? These are really the questions that we face as a collective here. And these were the questions of Yahara 2070. We've got some answers from the public in the reports, and I'm going to stop there. But I'm happy to take questions.
You said that our soil is rich in phosphorus?
Mm-hmm.
Why do they keep adding it to the soil?
That's a great question. And the people at the university and at UW Extension have gotten the message out that farmers can dial way back on phosphate fertilizer, and they have, especially after the, well, for in fact, in the city, you can no longer buy phosphate fertilizer for your lawn. You can still buy it for farms, but after the, in 2008, there were a series of global events that drove the price of phosphate rock up by about a factor of 8. And so that created a financial incentive to dial back. And so farmers really are applying way less phosphate fertilizer than they did in the past. But the big problem is manure. And that's been going on for my whole professional life. Manure production and manure discharge have been going up. You know, a pound of milk is about a pound of manure on the other end. And if you run a farm, manure is a waste product. You have to get it out of the barn because FDA will shut you down if you're running a milk or meat production operation in a barn full of manure. So for health reasons, you got to get the manure out of there. And what people do is plow it into the ground. And our land is way over-fertilized now.
My understanding...
You're good.
Okay. I can hear you.
My understanding is that the Yahara is not directly connected to the St. Lawrence Seaway.
No, it's directly connected to the Mississippi River.
So how are the zebra mussels getting in?
They get in on boats. So
even here?
No, they get to Lake Michigan. And then from Lake Michigan, that's a connection I missed. Good point. It turns out if you look at the DNR collects data of where people move boats from in the state, Lake Mendota is the most popular place to bring your boat if you take your boat out of Lake Michigan and move it to an inland lake. The lake that you're most likely to bring it to is Lake Mendota. So if you've been fishing on the Great Lakes and you fill your live well with Great Lakes water that has the juvenile stages of zebra mussels or has spiny water flea in it, and you then exchange water with Lake Mendota when you go fishing in Lake Mendota, you've just inoculated Lake Mendota.
It's us again.
Yeah. It's you. It's us. Yeah. We've met the, as Pogo said, we've met the enemy, and he's us. The question was, could I explain the differences, the overall differences in values or attitudes of the four groups? And I will try to nutshell it, but there was one group, and mostly I would say fairly environmentalist oriented, who just felt we should get the people out of here. We should just eliminate less people. And so we thought, well, what's a realistic story that would get most of the people out of here? Let's have the water toxicity just get completely out of hand, and which is not unrealistic. It's perfectly plausible story, and that way we can knock the population down to about 10% and explore the logical consequences of that for those people who have that interest. So that was really that was how we handled that group. There's actually a pretty sizable group within Dane County of technological optimists. And you know, there are a lot of people with scientific and engineering training. Actually, in many ways, I'm a technological optimist myself, but I see the threats as being larger than what we're doing. And there's also the perception is, hey, we have great biotech, we have great high tech, why don't we develop green tech? And then we can just use our watershed as a practice area. So, for example, the world really needs better ways to get phosphorus out of waste streams. Why don't we be the place that invents that technology and develops it? That's just one example. So that was one scenario. Third scenario, and this also sort of came out of the environmental community, but I know it's true from teaching young people and being around young people. Young people have different values, and they're more likely to have environmental values than this. I'm not saying that all of them do, and I'm not saying that all old people do not. But there is a really strong representation of environmental values among the young. And if you go to the Environmental Values Project, the name has fallen out of my head, but I gave it earlier. But it's the Values Project at University of Michigan. You can read about it, and there are articles about it in the popular press. Look at Greta Thunberg, you know, a 16-year-old woman who's inspiring everybody right now. One of my former students is now a professor in Ireland, and I had an email exchange with her recently about something else, and she said that with the Brexit vote coming up, one of the Brexit is the people who are for Brexit tend to be older, and it's a more backward-looking view of the world, and younger people see that they should just be part of Europe. And they do not want Brexit. And she told me that every month there's a net change of 6,000 votes against Brexit. And that's because of old voters dying and young voters coming of age. So the people who are opposed to Brexit now think that if they can just slow it down, the balance will tip. Yeah. Sorry for that long rambling answer, but you can read a more coherent description on our website.
Forward looking.
I think those are excellent points. I am not a sociologist, and but I read a lot, and I think a relevant quote is Winston Churchill said that a young man who is not liberal has no heart. An old man who is not conservative has no brain. I think that nutshells it pretty well.
That's back one last one, Steve. I spent most of my life helping people fight landfills.
Can't hear you, Mike's out.
When I came here as a student in the 1970s, I spent a year learning about the lakes, and then I asked, why are all these rich people putting up with this? And I don't know. I think part of it is they don't really want to fight the battle. There have been some leaders within the clubs for the different lakes who have taken strong positions from time to time, but you know they're in power for a couple of years. And I think it's an enormous oddity. Yeah. One thing you might be asking is, what can you do? And I think that eating meat that is farmed in an intensive way, industrially produced meat, is one of the largest impacts that we have on the environment. If you just look at the data, it's meat consumption that is the big one. That doesn't mean you have to be a vegetarian, but you can think about where your meat comes from. If you go to the co-op, for example, you'll see a lot of meat that is grass-fed. And grass-fed meat is much more expensive, okay, but it's much less harmful to the environment. So that's one thing you can also think about milk, and you can actually just read it on the bottle in most of the stores. Just buy grass-fed milk. It will be more expensive. And that represents the real cost of building in the environmental cost of milk into the milk. And
thank you. All right. Thank you for coming. Please extend the hand of friendship to those around you, and join us for coffee and conversation